Okay, so now we're going to talk about shock servers and mods. This can be found on pages 961 to 985, which is chapter 42. There are multiple different types of shock, and I'll just go ahead and tell you that shock is shock. A lot of the signs and symptoms, a lot of it's going to be the same, with the exception of cardiogenic. So we're going to talk about cardiogenic shock, hypovolemic, neurogenic, anaphylactic, and septic. And we will start with cardiogenic. So this is going to be systolic or diastolic dysfunction. And it's going to result in reduced cardiac output, stroke volume, and hypotension. So, systolic dysfunction, that's the heart's inability to pump the blood forward. And then diastolic dysfunction is the inability of the heart to fill. So, causes of systolic, so causes to make the heart not be able to pump. Cardiomyopathy, blunt cardiac injury, severe systemic or pulmonary hypertension, and then myocardial depression from different metabolic problems. And then causes of diastolic or causes that make our heart not be able to fill is going to be cardiac tamponade, ventricular hypertrophy, or cardiomyopathy. So this is our patho of cardiogenic shock. You see, we have a cardiac structural problem. And it's going to either be diastolic or systolic. And then if it's systolic, we're going to have decreased stroke volume, decreased cardiac output, which is going to decrease our oxygen supply, decrease tissue perfusion, and then impair cellular metabolism. With our diastolic, we're going to have increased pulmonary or PA pressures, increased pulmonary edema, decreased oxygen, which just cascades into the decreased tissue perfusion and impaired cellular metabolism. So, what does it look like? Early manifestations, tachycardia, hypotension, narrowed pulse pressure, and then increased myocardial oxygen consumption. They're going to be tachypneic. They might have pulmonary congestion, pallor, or cool, clammy skin, delayed capillary refill time. They might be anxious, agitated, confused. They're going to have the increased pulmonary artery wedge pressure and decreased pulmonary or decreased urinary output, excuse me. And then too, you have to think about there's the two different causes, the systolic and the diastolic. So the signs and symptoms are going to be based on whether it's systolic or diastolic. Our management for cardiogenic shock, so table 42.9 is going to show your interprofessional care, and then table 42.8 is going to show your drug therapy. So our goal is to restore the heart function, and then balance the supply and demand of oxygen in the myocardium. These people are going to need a cardiac catheterization as soon as possible. We need to determine the cause of the heart dysfunction. So the drug of choice is going to be based on the clinical goal. Some different examples of drugs are going to be, our nitrates, our diuretics, vasodilators, our beta-adrenergic blockers. Once again, it just depends on whether it's systolic or diastolic. Another therapy that might have to be done is our intra-aortic balloon pump. We just call these balloon pumps where I work. What that does is it is a literal balloon that sits in the aorta, and it opens and closes, and it kind of helps push the blood through the aorta. Or they might need a ventricular assist device. There's two different kinds. You have your right-sided ventricular device, and you have your left-sided. The ones that we use at my facility are called Impellas. We use these a lot for cardiogenic shock, as well as they will use them in the OR for open heart surgeries. And it's a little motor that sits in the ventricle, and what it does is it kind of sucks the blood up out of the ventricle, and then the little motor will push it out of the ventricle, and that just lets the ventricle rest. Another thing with cardiogenic shock is, you want to intervene as soon as possible because their chances of survival increase the earlier you intervene. 2 nights ago, we actually had what we call the heart reunion, and it was for the patients who we have used these devices on, these ventricular assist devices. And it was really cool to see how, these devices were literally able to save their life. So that's just a little tidbit. On to hypovolemic. So what happens in hypovolemic shock is basically we have decreased intravascular volume. So that's decreased volume in the vessels. And then if there's no volume in the vessels, then the venous return to the heart is low, preload is low, a stroke volume or cardiac output. Because if we don't have any volume getting to the heart, we don't have any volume for the heart to pump to the rest of the body. This is our patho of our hypovolemic shock. So whether it's relative or absolute, like we already talked about, we don't have enough volume in the vessels. We don't have enough circulating volume. So then when it gets to the heart, there's not enough volume for it to pump out. So that's decreasing your cardiac output, your stroke volume, your blood pressure, which therefore decreases your tissue perfusion. So what does it look like? Table 42.3 is the clinical presentation of shock. They're going to be anxious. A lot of them kind of are anxious and restless and have an impending sense of doom. Decrease urine output. Our kidneys aren't getting enough perfusion for them to work. So then your patients don't pee and they build up all those toxins, tachypnea and tachycardia, hypotension, and then signs and symptoms of decreased tissue perfusion. So our diagnostic and laboratory studies, these are just some of the things that, we're going to be monitoring. Your HNH, the electrolytes, because if our blood levels are low, then our electrolytes are out of whack. We're going to be looking at the lactate, so we're going to trend lactic acids. We're going to be looking at our ABGs, our arterial blood gases, which Ms. Montgomery spoke with you all about. The mixed central venous O2 saturations, and then hourly urine output is huge. So the management and interprofessional care, you can find this on table 42.9. Our number one goal is to stop the fluid loss and then restore the volume. So these patients are going to need about 3 cc's of isotonic crystalloid for every 1 mL of estimated blood loss. And you can find all the details of fluid therapy on table 42.7. Distributive shock encompasses our neurogenic, our anaphylactic, and our sepsis. So this is widespread vasodilation and increased capillary permeability. And then the first one we're going to talk about is neurogenic. So your book describes this as a hemodynamic phenomenon. It occurs within 30 minutes of a neuro injury and can last up to 6 weeks. And it is seen a lot with cervical or high thoracic injury. There's massive vasodilation without any kind of compensation because of the loss of SNS vasoconstrictor tone. And that leads to pooling of blood in the vessels, which is, gives us the tissue hypoperfusion and then impaired cellular metabolism. Another cause of this can be spinal anesthesia. So, what does it look like? Hypotension, bradycardia, the inability to regulate body temperature, dry skin. The thing about the skin, though, is that it's warm and dry at first because of the massive vasodilation, but then so management of patients with neurogenic shock, the treatment's going to be based on the cause. With the spinal cord injury, you want to promote the spinal stability. They're going to need a C collar, cervical stabilization, spinal precautions. You're going to treat the hypotension and the bradycardia by giving vasopressors, have atropine ready. We're going to very cautiously infuse any kind of fluids because their hypotension is not related to fluid loss. And then we want to make sure that they do not become hypothermic. Anaphylactic shock is next. So, this is an acute life-threatening hypersensitivity. It causes massive vasodilation. And it releases the vasoactive mediators and increased capillary permeability, which causes fluid to leak into the interstitial space, which we know is third spacing. It looks like respiratory distress due to laryngeal edema or severe bronchospasm. And this is a very sudden onset of symptoms. It can be dizziness, chest pain. They can have incontinence, swelling of lips and tongue. Is common wheezing and stridor. So, if your patient has stridor and then you don't hear it anymore, that is very bad. That means that they're not moving any kind of air. Skin changes, they might be flushed, they could have angioedema. We know that that's the edema around the neck and face. They're going to have the impending sense of doom, anxiety. They might become confused. So the first strategy in managing anaphylactic shock is to prevent it. They need to have, or we need to get a thorough history on this patient. Epinephrine is the first drug of choice. If somebody has a known like anaphylactic allergy, they need to have their EpiPen on them at all times, and know how to use it, as well as their family members need to know how to use it. They might need Benadryl and histamine receptor blockers for adjunct therapy. We want to maintain a patent airway. They're going to need aggressive fluid resuscitation due to that third spacing. They might need inhaled bronchodilators, and they might need the IV corticosteroids if the hypotension persist after adequate fluid resuscitation. So this is the sepsis continuum. You have your SIRS, your sepsis, severe sepsis, and then septic shock. So let's talk about the systemic inflammatory response syndrome. So this is a systemic inflammatory response, as the name tells us, but it's to a variety of insults, including infection, ischemia, infarction, and injury. So I've listed the triggers here, like a mechanical tissue trauma could be burns, or a crush injury or surgery. Global perfusion deficit can be post cardiac resuscitation. Microbial invasion can be, just infection. Abscess formation, especially the intra-abdominal abscesses. So this slide kind of shows you how the continuum advances. So that's just there for some fun facts. And then table 4210 shows the manifestations and the management of SIRS and MODS. It's a really good table. So moving into septic shock, it's persistent hypotension despite the fluid resuscitation, and it's also inadequate tissue perfusion. So you can see the patho here of what happens. You have an invading microorganism, and it's going to cause the myocardial depression, the pro-inflammatory cytokine release, endothelial damage, and the activation of the CNS and endocrine systems. It's going to put your patient in a hypermetabolic state. They're going to have selective vasoconstriction. They might have microemboli, increased capillary permeability, peripheral vasodilation. Basically, what happens is your body is going to try to get all the blood to the vital organs. And so it might shunt some blood. It is going to decrease the tissue perfusion. It is going to increase your, or it's going to cause a hypermetabolic state, and it's going to decrease the cellular oxygen supply. So what does it look like? You're going to have increased coagulation factors and inflammation. The hyperdynamic state, that's your increased cardiac output and decreased systemic vascular resistance. They're going to have decreased urine output. Our kidneys are not getting perfused like they need to. They're going to be tachypneic, and they might be hyperventilating, which would cause them to be acidotic as they're blowing off too much CO2. Altered mental status, confusion, anxious, and then some GI dysfunction, GI bleeding, paralytic ileus, because our body is trying to protect itself by shunting the blood. So management, they're going to need large amounts of fluid replacement to restore the volume inside the vessels to give our organs the perfusion it needs. So this is going to be about 30 mils per kilogram of isotonic crystalloids. They're going to need hemodynamic monitoring. Continuous telemetry, a Foley catheter to measure urine output. They'll need vasopressors if they're not responsive to the fluid resuscitation. Norepinephrine or Levofed is our first drug of choice. And vasopressin is added if they need more support. The thing about vasopressors that you have to keep in mind, if your patient's on them, they are titratable drugs. So we titrate them based on our blood pressure. The other thing is that it's vasoconstricting. So it is constricting the vessels in the extremities. So you will have to keep assessing their extremities, their capillary refill, their distal pulses, skin temperature and color and sensation. And then you want to obtain cultures and start broad spectrum antibiotics within an hour of the first signs and symptoms of septic shock. This is the septic shock 1 hour bundle from your book. Most facilities have, these sepsis bundles of criteria that you do within the hour. So, we want to get a lactic acid level. If it's greater than 2, we will continue to trend it. So we'll get another one in 3 hours and trend it for 3 hours until it falls below 2. You want to get blood cultures, as well as any other cultures that are ordered before you administer antibiotics, so we can figure out the specific type of antibiotic that we need. And once we get those cultures, we're going to administer those broad spectrum antibiotics. You're going to begin the rapid administration of fluids for the fluid resuscitation, and then you'll administer vasopressors if the fluid resuscitation was not successful. So multiple organ dysfunction syndrome, or MODS. This is when you have a failure of two or more organ systems in acutely ill patients, and this results from SIRS. So what does it look like? Your respiratory system is going to be the first to show signs of dysfunction. They're going to have alveolar edema and a decrease in surfactant, and they can very easily go into ARDS. Your cardiovascular, you're going to have massive vasodilation and myocardial depression. You're going to have hypotension and a decreased SVR. Albumin and fluid move out of the vessels into the interstitial space, and you're going to have increased CVP and PA pressures. Neurologically, mental status changes, confusion, restlessness, and this is often an early sign of MODS. They might be combative as well. For renal and hematologic, acute kidney injury is huge. You know, our body's shunting the blood to the vital organs, which typically is going to be the brain, the heart, the lungs. And then I would say that the kidneys are fourth, but they're very sensitive to hypoperfusion. So you're going to have decreased urine output, which also gives you electrolyte imbalances and metabolic acidosis. These people can also go into DIC very easily. Your GI system, once again, due to the hypoperfusion, you're going to have decreased motility, abdominal distension, paralytic ileus. They're at an increased risk for like stress ulcers and GI bleeds. The hypermetabolic state, they can be hyper or hypoglycemic. They might develop insulin resistance. The liver dysfunction, that kind of goes into the DIC because that's where a lot of our clotting factors comes from, and lactic acidosis. So obstructive shock, this occurs when a physical obstruction stops blood flow to the heart. So it decreases cardiac output. It's caused by the restricted diastolic filling of the right ventricle from compression. That can happen from cardiac tamponade, tension pneumothorax, or abdominal compartment syndrome. And that's when the increased abdominal pressures compress against the inferior vena cava. This is the patho of obstructive shock, which is what we just talked about. You know, there's some kind of structural compression, and it decreases the flow of blood, the venous return, stroke volume, cardiac output, the cellular oxygen supply, which decreases tissue perfusion, and it impairs cellular metabolism. So what does it look like? Once again, decreased cardiac output, decreased afterload, JVD. For obstructive shock, rapid assessment and immediate treatment are vital. So that's our main strategy in our management of care, is the early recognition and treatment. They might need a mechanical decompression. If it's caused from a pulmonary embolism, they need immediate anticoagulation. They might need a decompressive laparotomy for the abdominal compartment syndrome. So it's all just going to come from relieving the pressure on the heart. So now we're going to talk about the stages of shock. So the initial stage is not always clinically apparent. You're not gonna look at your patient and be like, oh yeah, they're in the initial stage of shock. Because this occurs at a cellular level. Lactic acid starts to build up because the process that your body does to remove that, it's lacking oxygen because there's not enough tissue perfusion. So that's why the lactic acid builds up. The compensatory stage, this is when you're able to start seeing it in your patient. There's an imbalance in oxygen supply and demand. Hypotension is huge. We've talked about the shunning of the blood to the vital organs. They're gonna have cool, clammy skin, impaired gut motility. And then the progressive stage, the circulating volume decreases with an increase in systemic interstitial edema. So fluid continues to move out of the vessels into the interstitial space. Changes in mental status are important findings here. The cardiovascular system is very much affected. And then they're going to need aggressive, quick interventions to prevent ARDS. The refractory stage, this is the last stage. Recovery is unlikely if they make it to this stage. There's a failure of the liver, the lungs, and the kidneys. So waste products build up in the blood, and your body is unable to filter those out. So the next few slides are going to be just the signs and symptoms of your body in the stages. So the compensatory, they might be oriented to person, place, and time, not really situation, restless, confused. They might have a change in level of consciousness, are cardiovascular. There's may be vasoconstriction with coronary artery dilation, hypotension, increased heart rate. Our kidneys have decreased blood flow. So that means decreased urine output. Our lungs, they might have a ventilation perfusion mismatch, hyperventilation, tachypnea because of the decreased blood flow to the lungs. The progressive stage, they're going to have decreased cerebral perfusion pressure, cerebral blood flow, and responsiveness to stimuli. Cardiac wise, this is when dysrhythmias can occur. Myocardial ischemia, MI, decreased pulses, distal pulses, and cap refill. Our stomach, we can have ischemic gut, impaired absorption. Kidneys, decrease urine output, increase urine sodium, metabolic acidosis. Our liver cannot metabolize drugs and waste products, and then your patient can go into ARDS. Non-compliance. When we say that their lungs are non-compliant, it basically means that they're not inflating and deflating the way that they need to perform gas exchange. They might have moist crackles, alveolar edema. So some diagnostic and lab studies. So page 964, table 42.2 shows a lot of these. The thing about finding, lab and diagnostic studies is there's not a single study to determine it. You're going to have to look at several different lab values and diagnostics to determine the cause of shock, which we know is the ultimate treatment, is to fix the cause. And so you're just going to have to work with the healthcare provider and assess your patient to see what's going on. If it's cardiogenic, you might need a echocardiogram, a cardiac catheterization to determine the cause of it. If it's septic, we need to find the source of the sepsis. So And then same with hypovolemic, you got to find the source of the bleeding to fix it. So some management is oxygen is huge. So we want to increase the supply and decrease the demand. You're going to optimize your cardiac output with fluid replacement. You might have to give them blood products. They might need mechanical ventilation. You also want to space any activities. So you want to like bundle your care that you give to your patients, but also space it out. Because all of those things are going to increase oxygen consumption, like ET suctioning and position changes. And then fluid resuscitation, cornerstone of therapy, because it restores the tissue perfusion and increases your cardiac output. You're going to need one or two large bore IVs, or a IO access, or a central venous catheter is probably the most realistic. Also, if you get a IO access, there's a chart in your book, I think, but just make sure that you remove that as soon as possible once you obtain another kind of intravenous access. So drug therapy, our goal is to correct the decreased tissue perfusion. Page 973, table 42.8 outlines a lot of this. We've talked about vasopressors. These are going to be to achieve and then maintain a MAP of 65 or greater, but we're going to be continuously monitoring for end organ perfusion. So that's our level of consciousness for our brain. That is our urine output. We're going to be measuring lactate levels to see if those are trending down. Our vasodilators decreases the afterload by reducing the myocardial workload and the oxygen requirements. This is in cardiogenic shock. We're going to monitor our hemodynamics. That's our blood pressure, our heart rate, our cardiac output, our pulmonary artery pressure. And we want to continue to maintain a MAP of 65 or greater. Nutritional therapy. So this is very important because our body needs calories to have energy to complete all of these processes. So it needs to be started within the first 24 hours. Enteral nutrition does. It helps maintain the gut mucosa, which decreases the risk. Make sure our patients have daily weights. And then we're gonna have to monitor the serum protein, albumin, prealbumin, electrolytes, glucose, and BUN.